From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You know how yesterday we were talking about music and how it's hard to keep up with the scene these days? Well, you could say the same about fitness. You find some exercise routine or a diet plan, and here comes a study or an article or a report that tells you it's all wrong. Gretchen Reynolds says what we're learning about the moving body is a flying target, and what we're learning is surprising, like stretching before a run. It's not really necessary or, in fact, good for you, and walking is probably better. Reynolds is the physical education columnist for the New York Times, and today in the program, she's joining us to explain what science is telling us about working out and losing weight. Just a warning, this will probably challenge some of your own ideas. Oh, and one of her favorite scientific discoveries? Two words, chocolate milk. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Gretchen Reynolds' new book, in fact, most all of the writing that she does for the New York Times, is about the body in motion. But not just that, it's about change, how what we understand about exercise and fitness is changing and evolving. It may seem like every week there's a study that contradicts the one before about diets and workout plans, but Reynolds says science is moving forward. We can measure the body and see into it better than we ever have. So, she says, her book is partly an overview of that research and those studies, but she also wants it to be a user's manual. She wants people to take this stuff and put it into action. When it comes right down to it, she wants us all to get up from time to time and get moving. We're continuing our series on fitness today. Gretchen Reynolds is joining us. You can join us as well. You must have questions. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Gretchen Reynolds is the phys ed columnist for the New York Times. She's the author of the book, The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, and Live Longer. She's joining us today from a studio in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where she's based. Gretchen Reynolds, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, you've been writing about this for a while now. I'm wondering how difficult it is to cover all of this. If the science is, shifting, yeasty is in fact the word you use in the book. I mean, do you worry that, you know, anything you're going to write about or say right now is going to be definitive for any amount of time if things are always shifting a little?
I look at it as the Health Writers Full Employment Act, that the science does keep changing. And I think it's important because it keeps changing that we keep covering it. Yeah. No scientist will tell you that they think that they have ever fully understood anything. And so particularly when it concerns the body and how the body works, it is so complicated. I mean, it's just remarkable that we can take a step. Mm. I mean, it involves so many different systems. It involves your brain, your eyes, your nutrition. It involves everything. So it's not surprising that only piece by piece are scientists beginning to understand how the human body works and how we can help it to work really well. And it's not surprising that they will think they understand something, and as they learn more, they will realize that they were either wrong or just subtly not right. And it's really interesting as a journalist to watch that process unfold. I personally find it fascinating.
Yeah. Well, that seems to be one of the takeaways for you over all of this, is just how incredibly complicated the body is and how one thing works against another. And if you change one dynamic, then it sort of throws everything into change. You know, I mean, homing in on it is pretty complicated.
But at the same time, we are all really good at owning a body.
Yeah.
It's. I mean, if we had to actually tell our body how to walk, I'd be completely lost.
Right.
The body's really good at doing those things. What scientists are trying to figure out is how, in fact, the body does those things and how, in those instances when something isn't working perfectly, even in terms of, you know, too much weight or whatever, what can be done to help the body function at its best.
Mm. You know, the idea of listening to your body seems another takeaway in some way. When you're talking about how much water we're supposed to take, for example, or how much food we're supposed to eat, it seems like in some ways we're not paying attention to that basic concept. Am I thirsty right now, for example?
One of the big themes, I think, in exercise science now is the very common sense message that by and large, your body actually does know what you should do. And when we, meaning our sort of conscious self, try to impose something different on the body, mm-hmm. it's usually a mistake. And that's really true in terms of the issue of thirst. I don't know how many listeners out there used to do marathons, say, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I started doing marathons back then, 20 years ago. We were all told you have to stay ahead of your thirst. Yeah. You have to make sure that you never get thirsty, that you're drinking before you feel any kind of thirst. We would never tell people stay ahead of your hunger. Right. The body's thirst mechanism is actually a beautifully attuned system for knowing when you need to hydrate. So if you actually listen to your body when it says, I need some fluids. Mm. People tend to be almost perfect in terms of adding back in the fluid that they've lost. When they do things, and this is good science showing this, when people, quote unquote, stay ahead of their thirst, they're almost always drinking too much. Mm. And it is possible, especially if you're doing something like a slow 4, 5, 6 hour marathon, to drink so much more than you sweat out that you actually can make yourself sick. It can even be fatal. And that's a condition that we as humans have completely created by not listening to our own bodies.
In the book, you refer to this study done in part by biologists here at the University of Utah, in fact. And the idea was to figure out how humans move and how that's different, for example, from other creatures. And they asked these study volunteers to move, to run and walk in these different ways. And there's this idea that persists that humans are born to run. But the study found that it's not really true. We were born, I think this is how you put it, we were born to stroll.
Yes, which is a wonderfully encouraging message, actually. And if you think about it, it does make sense. Born to run is a nice phrase. But in fact, human beings, when they were evolving, did become creatures that followed prey. You can only follow prey at a dead run for so long. Yeah. What humans turned out to be really good at is to keep following prey for a long, long time at a pace that was tolerable, which was mostly a sort of brisk walk with an occasional run thrown in. And these other animals would just keel over eventually in the heat, because another adaptations humans have is we don't have a lot of hair, right. So we can keep going a long time. That appears to be a really strong evolutionary adaptation, is that humans are phenomenally good at walking.
Yeah.
We're not actually good at running for long, long periods of time. We've actually become better at that, at running marathons. It looks like, from an evolutionary standpoint, that early man did a lot of long walks with some sprinting thrown in, and that's bred right into our bodies, that we need to be moving, but you don't have to be doing it at a run. Mm. And we use much less oxygen, meaning that we're really physiologically efficient. When we walk, we're much more efficient walking than running, and we're much more efficient as a species walking than almost any other mammal.
Yeah.
So for those people who have felt bad because they don't like running, you're fine. Evolutionarily, yeah. You're perfect.
Yeah. So this question that comes up all the time, you hear it among runners. All right, do we land on the balls of our feet or do we land on our toes? It doesn't really matter in some ways.
Well, it does and it doesn't. Yeah. Part of the born to run and barefoot running phenomenon involves this idea that it's more natural, first of all, to run without shoes, which it is if you were born 10,000 years ago. It's certainly not true now. It's natural for us to wear shoes because we do. If, though, you don't wear shoes and you don't wear shoes from birth, you generally tend to run on the balls of your foot or towards the ball of your foot. Not always, though. There was an interesting study that came out just earlier this year that looked at a tribe in Kenya. Kenyans, of course, are famously great distance runners. And there had been this idea that all Kenyans who grew up running barefoot were also forefoot runners. They landed near the front of their feet. A group of scientists went and studied another tribe that don't run quite as fast as some of the really fast Kenyans, but grew up barefoot. When they ran hitting on their heels, which is the way most of us in the West do. So it's not completely clear that the quote-unquote only natural way to run is to land near the balls of your feet. And those of us who've grown up wearing regular Western running shoes almost always land on our heels. That's just become built in to how we move. Every part of your body is adapted to moving that way and to landing that way when you run. So if you rather abruptly take off your shoes and start running, you will actually find that it can hurt. And it hurts because you will continue to hit your heels. You will not have padding. You don't have shoes on. And how the forces move up your leg is still going to be the same as if you had shoes on. So what has been happening a lot is that people have heard that barefoot running will basically make them injury-free as a runner. And they take off their shoes, they try running, and there has been just an epidemic of running-related injuries from people who've switched to barefoot running. If you are going to try to transition into being a barefoot or barefoot-style runner, someone wearing the really light, often five-fingered running shoes, you have to do it really slowly. You have to do it very gradually. And you have to understand that, frankly, it may not work in terms of helping you transition into becoming a sort of four-foot style runner. Most people who try to switch the way that they've always run find that they can't. Mm. They can while they're thinking about it, while you're saying to yourself, I have to land near my toes. The minute you stop thinking about it, if it's not something that you've ever done, you often will return to your old style. Mm. And that, which is generally fine. Actually, once again, your body usually finds the right way for you to run, whether you're wearing shoes or not. So if you are a runner right now who likes your running shoes, who's not injured, don't change anything. Mm. You're doing everything right.
You know, one thing that science shows us, you say in the book, is that no part of our body is static. You know, we're designed to keep moving. And there's all this talk about how it is that obesity has become such a problem in this country and most developed countries. And clearly, you know, overly processed food is something to do with that and portion size and stuff like that. But are we just doing more sitting than we ever have? Because you say we are more sitting than any time in human history.
Yes. And in fact, there was a study that came out recently that showed that for the first time ever, people were spending far more time sitting than sleeping. It used to be that when they studied inactivity, meaning the times when your body is quiet, that the number one form of inactivity was sleeping, which is fine. The body needs to be asleep. But when the amount of time that you are spending sitting, which is a form of almost complete inactivity, when that is greater than even the amount of time you're sleeping, and you put those two together, that means that your body is almost inert physiologically for 17 hours of the day or more. They have done studies that have shown that a lot of people who work in offices are spending 9, 10, 11 hours between the office, their car, and sitting in front of the television, just sitting. Mm. And that turns out to be remarkably unhealthy, even if you exercise, which was actually a pretty big scientific discovery. I don't think that the scientists themselves had expected to find out that those of us who are, quote unquote, active couch potatoes, meaning people who go out and run once a day and then sit the entire rest of the day, have almost the same risk of heart disease, diabetes, even early onset dementia, and obesity as people who are not exercising but simply stand up and move around more often.
You point out that this question of whether we're getting enough exercise used to be kind of a moot point because, as you say in the book, the cows needed tending to, the corn needed to be dealt with. And, you know, you also make this point kind of you don't see a lot of Amish people who are fat.
No, in fact, you see almost none. That was another very interesting study where they actually scientists went in and it had the Amish people, despite their feelings about modern technology, wear monitors that are called accelerometers that really measure how much people move and how much they sit. And the Amish people, just during their daily lives, they don't exercise, they don't go to gyms, but the men were walking as much as 10 miles a day. The women were walking as much as 7 or 8 every single day. Our grandparents or great-grandparents generally moved far more than we do and didn't exercise at all. But they had far more movement during what's called activities of daily living. They vacuumed more. Yep. They gardened more. They obviously, if they had more on a farm, they were out dealing with the cows, dealing with all of that. Movement was built into daily lives. Now, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing that we're in offices, that we have cars, that we have all of these conveniences. But the effect has been to change the environment for our bodies and to make it far more unlikely that we will be moving very much. Mm. We go out and exercise. Yeah. So for half an hour a day or, you know, maybe even an hour, we go out and exercise. Then we sit the whole rest of the day. That is not, in fact, what our bodies are built for. They really are, as we talked about before, they are built from an evolutionary standpoint to be moving a lot, but not necessarily really hard all the time.
How many?
And we don't do it.
I don't want to put you on the spot here because you may not be able to recall the exact number, but you do mention it in the book. How many steps does the average American take today? Do you know that offhand?
It's less than 5,000.
Yeah.
And the sort of minimum that's generally suggested for good health is at least 10,000 a day. I believe that and the total is going down. The average total is dropping. Just about every time they study it, it becomes less and less. And what's particularly interesting is when they ask people how much or how many steps do you take or how much do you walk during the day, and then they have those same people wear an accelerometer, people usually overestimate by about 50% how much they are actually moving around. So even some of the studies that have found that people are walking 5,000 or taking 5,000 steps a day, if they're based on the people's own estimates, they're almost certainly way too high. Mm. We are an incredibly sedentary society now. And it is, it's certainly contributing to obesity, and it contributes very directly to things like life expectancy, heart disease, and things you wouldn't expect, like dementia.
You say in the book this question of how much exercise people need and how much is, you know, too much and how much is too little is, here's how you put it, a big fat mess. So we know we're supposed to move, but the question that always comes up is how? How are we supposed to move? What do we know about that?
What we know in very broad terms is up to a very uncertain limit, the more the better, in terms of movement. Yeah. But that does not mean that it has to be something like training for a marathon.
Right.
When they have done studies of sort of whether there's an upper limit, there is some evidence, and this will apply to such a tiny group of people.
Yeah.
If you work out really strenuously for, say, 90 minutes every day of the week, there is some and growing evidence that it may be unhealthy for the human heart.
Right.
That is so few people. Too much exercise is not actually a problem in the United States.
Right.
The much bigger issue is sort of how little can we get away with.
Right, right.
And that's any time I write about how little exercise you can do, the columns are immensely popular.
Yeah. So American of us, isn't it?
Well, yes, although I think people tend to misread the headline. I've written a couple of columns about, you know, getting fit in 4 minutes.
Right.
And there is a very clear interest in among physiologists in finding out how people can get the benefits of exercise in terms of improving their aerobic fitness, reducing risk of disease, and fit it into a very busy life, since most people are not exercising at all.
Mm.
You can, in fact, get very fit in a 4-minute workout if you're willing to make it very strenuous. There's a really interesting body of science looking at whether you can trade off sort of time spent mm-hmm. exercising for intensity in your exercise. And you can. You can get all the benefits, it appears, of about a 90-minute run in between 6 and 10 minutes of really hard bike riding or running. But that means it has to be quite unpleasant.
Yeah.
But if you really are in a hurry and you're willing to make yourself hurt, you can do what's called high-intensity interval training and get both the health and fitness benefits of a much longer workout. And that's certainly attractive.
Yeah. We'll come back to that, actually. I want to talk about some of the particulars there. You write about this report that was published by in this Journal of American College Sports Medicine. And one of the findings made, you know, complete sense. People who exercised moderately, you know, didn't go crazy, but did some kind of exercise, reported fewer so-called unhealthy days, where they, you know, days where they're achy or anxious or unhappy, which is not surprising, that finding. But what was surprising was that a good proportion of those who were working out and working out vigorously and all the time, they also had a lot of unhealthy days.
Yes, it's surprising unless you read a lot of the literature, and that the best literature about or science about how much exercise is the ideal amount almost invariably finds that it is a moderate amount of exercise.
Yeah.
And there are several reasons why that's true. And by moderate, that generally means going for a 30-minute walk almost every day of the week. There was a very interesting study presented last year at the American College of Sports Medicine that found that in terms of prolonging your lifespan, the sweet spot from exercise was running very gently at about an 11-minute mile pace three times a week for 30 minutes. Doing less than that, you didn't live as long. Doing a lot more than that, you also didn't live as long. So moderate exercise appears to be really healthy. It also has the very interesting benefit of not making people so tired that they don't move the rest of the day.
Yeah.
People who exercise moderately tend to then actually be the most active in light duty things the rest of the day. They stand up more. They're a little more likely to take the stairs. They're a little more likely to walk to their mailbox instead of sending their child to go get the mail.
Yeah.
People who exercise really strenuously have been found to actually move around less during the rest of the day. And that may be because they have less time. They've spent a lot of time exercising. There's also some evidence that they are physiologically a little more tired.
Yeah.
So over the course of the whole day, they actually are maybe taking fewer steps and sitting more than someone who appears to be exercising less than they are. So it's an interesting issue of what's the perfect amount of exercise, although every scientist would tell you anything at all is better than nothing.
Right. I guess we should point out, as you do in the book, that there is a lot of variability in the way different people respond to different exercise. I mean, you write this. You say walking 3 miles a day will almost certainly improve most people's health and fitness. Running 4 marathons a year might not, unless it does. So, you have to take into account who you are, what you're doing. I mean, this is personal stuff in some ways.
Well, and the genetics of exercise and exercise response is just a fascinating field that I think scientists are only starting to understand some of those issues. There is such a thing as exercise non-response or non-responders to exercise, where they really have found that in big studies of exercise training, there will always be some people whose aerobic fitness does not improve. Some people whose aerobic fitness seems to actually become worse. You can send them on a long walking program and they don't get more fit. That's a very tiny percentage of people, but it does seem to have a genetic basis. And there are intimations that if someone doesn't respond to, say, a running, or a jogging or walking program, they don't seem to be getting fitter. Their lung capacity is not improving. They're not losing weight. Sometimes those people are really good responders to a weight training program. So there may come a time as scientists really begin to understand, you know, which genes seem to be involved in exercise response, where you might be able to take a gene test and have it say to you, you're probably not designed to be a jogger. You should take up weight training or possibly swimming or something. We're not there yet.
Yeah.
And very few people actually don't respond to exercise at all. If, for instance, you don't improve your aerobic capacity, you might still reduce your risk for type 2 diabetes or heart disease. So don't look at this as an excuse. I think some people are already saying, oh, I have a feeling I'm a non-responder,
right,
so I won't bother. It's a very interesting and complicated field of science right now. But the main message is everyone will get something out of moving. You just might need to find the best way for you to move.
Gretchen Reynolds is with us. She writes the Phys Ed column for the New York Times Well blog. Her book is called The First 20 Minutes: Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, Live Longer. We'll take some of your calls when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on fitness with Gretchen Reynolds. She writes the Phys Ed column for the New York Times Well blog. She's explaining what the science is really saying about our bodies and how we're supposed to move them and work them out. Her book is called The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, Live Longer. 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I wanted to ask you, there's a chapter in your book called The Losing Battle, and it raises this question. In terms of, you know, because you have to make the distinction. I mean, for people who are just trying to stay fit or stay healthy or be athletes, there's a difference between that and trying to lose weight. And in terms of weight control, what's more important, diet or exercise?
Diet.
Yeah.
I think many people find it really discouraging that and this is shown over and over in the science and also in real life experience that exercise on its own, if you don't also control your diet, does not generally lead to weight loss. Yeah. Most of us have known someone who started training for a marathon and gained weight. That's really common, especially for women. And it's because, or the scientists believe it's because, when you exercise, and especially if you do sort of long, slow sort of exercise, if you're going for long, relatively slow jogs. Also, if you're a woman, exercise tends to spark the release of more appetite hormones. It increases your body's desire for food. Your body knows that, you know, when you exercise, you're using up energy. Mm-hmm. It wants you to replace that. So, and many people also overestimate how many calories they've burned. You go for a 30-minute walk, you're doing all sorts of wonderful things for your body, but you're not burning a huge amount of calories. Mm. If you then have a sports drink and a cookie, you have now taken in more calories than you just burned. And your body may be telling you to. You do tend to release more of the hunger hormones after exercise. So if you are using exercise to lose weight, it just seems indisputable that you have to cut calories, or you certainly have to not eat more calories than you were before you started exercising. It really still does come down to energy burned, energy taken in.
Yeah.
If you take in fewer calories than you have used, you will lose weight. On the other hand, and this is the encouraging part of this message, yeah. Once you have lost weight, however you do it, with a combination of diet and exercise or diet alone, exercise seems to be the way your body helps to eventually reset its sort of set point in terms of where it thinks you should be. Exercise is the only thing that seems to be really good at helping people keep weight off and avoid regaining the weight. It does help the body reapportion how you use calories. And so if you have lost weight, you almost certainly need to either continue or start an exercise program to maintain that weight loss. Just don't look at exercise as the way you're going to lose weight if that's all you do.
There, you write about this brief period when you were in young adulthood where you took up bike racing. And you say you got a lot of insights about the value of food for athletes. You write about in the book how sports nutrition is in the midst of this kind of shift in perspective. Talk about what we're learning and how the perspective is changing in terms of our diet.
I think nutrition is another instance where science is actually returning in some ways to what our grandparents were telling us all along, which is eat food that's natural, as unprocessed as you can, and don't eat more of it than you need. And that's actually – those are really important messages for sports nutrition as well as nutrition in general. I mean, you can now buy all of these fancy gels and bars and drinks and all of that. You can also get the same benefits from those and more nutritional value from normal foods. You do have to eat them at the right times, though, and many people don't necessarily know if they're an athlete. And again, this portion of the conversation would be directed towards someone who is trying to improve their competitive performance. Right. If you're going out for a walk, frankly, sports nutrition is just not applicable to you. Avoid sports drinks. They're just empty calories. Yeah. You don't need a Clif Bar. You don't need any of that. Have some water and you'll be fine. If you are training for a marathon or if you are doing long bike rides, even if you're not competitive, if you are working out strenuously for at least 45 minutes or longer, you do need to think about your nutrition immediately before, during, and after your workout. Mm-hmm. The evidence is pretty clear that beforehand, you can eat if you want to, have something that's fairly easy to digest. There was a really interesting study that showed that bananas were actually more effective at providing energy for runners than all of these fancy gels. So have a banana. You can also carry a banana if you don't squish it with you. It's a very fine mid-workout energy boost. If you, as I said, if you're going for 45 minutes or longer, you probably are going to need some carbohydrates during a workout. You will burn through pretty much everything you have stored in your muscles. So that's an instance when a sports drink can be very effective. The evidence is really clear that it does improve performance and it makes you feel better to have both carbohydrates and some hydration during a long workout.
Yeah.
Then afterwards is the fun part.
Yeah, for you. Chocolate milk? Are you getting to chocolate milk?
Yes, I am. If you have been working out hard, you've done two things essentially to your muscles. You have burned through all of their stored fuel. You've also caused some small muscle damage. That is the point of training. It really is this effort to slightly damage the muscles and have them repair themselves and be stronger. But in order to do that, the muscles need two things. They need carbohydrates to replace the fuel. They also need some protein. That will help them to repair themselves. It also appears to help the muscles pull in the blood sugar, the fuel, better than if you don't have protein. So after a hard workout, you need ideally a recovery beverage with carbohydrates and protein. And scientifically, this was good science, too. It wasn't funded by the chocolate milk companies.
Right.
It was really surprising that chocolate milk appears to have an almost ideal ratio of carbohydrates to protein. And it also, when they did a big study with runners, they actually lost body fat. If they were replacing their lost, if they were recovering with chocolate milk as opposed to some of the prepared recovery beverages. So if you've gone for a long run, make yourself a chocolate milk and you don't need to buy, you know, the fancy, expensive and not as tasty recovery beverages.
Yeah. Let's say one more thing about diet before we head into a break. Carb loading, not so good. That makes you fat, you say.
Well, it makes you temporarily fat, which is when you right before you are going to do your event.
Yeah.
It's funny. Again, those of us who used to do marathons in the old days were told we had to carbo load. And in fact, when you eat a whole lot of carbohydrates, it also draws a lot of water into your muscle cells. You wind up bloated. And it's even more true for women than for men. So you do all this carbohydrate loading and you arrive at the starting line relatively heavy. You have to carry that weight through the race, which is much harder than not carbo loading, not carrying the weight and just eating normally. Although there is some evidence that having a good, really good carbohydrate-rich meal the night before and some additional carbohydrates the morning of a marathon does help. But you don't need to carbo load all week and probably should not.
Gretchen Reynolds is with us. She writes the Phys Ed column for the New York Times Well blog, author of the book The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, Live Longer. We need to take another break, and we'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Gretchen Reynolds. She writes the Phys Ed column for the New York Times Well blog, author of the book The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, Live Longer. 801-585-WEST, the number two. Join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. Lisa has been waiting in Salt Lake. Lisa, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
No problem. Thanks, Doug. I just wanted to get Gretchen's thoughts on this. There's been some correlation. You sort of spoke about it a little bit earlier in the program. Endurance, athletics, and the heart, we kind of know that there's some potential link to AFib, some hypertrophy as endurance athletes get older. But now they're showing some left ventricular scarring, things that could be much more serious. And I was just wondering what her thoughts were on that and if she's heard anything up to this.
You write about this, Gretchen Reynolds, the question of whether you can actually scar your heart if you run a lot.
Yes, and in fact, read next week's New York Times column. I'm actually going to be writing about some new research on this very topic, and I'll give you a preview, which is that it does appear that heavy endurance exercise, and this is really either training very hard for a marathon or doing multiple marathons, or in this case also doing really long distance skiing, does appear to result in a greater incidence of, as your caller said, AFib, which is an issue with heart rhythm. Mm-hmm. They also have found scarring in multiple parts of really long-term endurance athletes' hearts. On the other hand, those athletes were alive. They were not dropping dead of heart attacks. Mm-hmm. So it's not completely clear yet what the practical implications of some of these changes are. We know an athlete's heart is different physiologically than a sedentary person's heart. It is larger. It does have it could look like an abnormal heart if you didn't know that was an athlete. Hmm. Clearly, that's desirable. What's going on with the scarring and the other issues is not clear, but there is a lot of research being done, so we may know more.
Yeah. And I guess we'll come back to the point that you mentioned and one of the doctors mentioned in your book, too much exercise has not been the big problem in the country. Let's go to the...
No, it's not. Never will be.
Yeah. The user manual part of all of this, you know, how much and what kind. I mean, experts suggest in the book, you mentioned this, 150 minutes of moderate activity each week like walking or 75 minutes a week of vigorous activity like running. And you can throw some weight training in there as well. You talk about how you can, if you want to push further, you can sort of increase the intensity. Know when to back off, you say, as well. Mm-hmm. And then you also mentioned this. This is the great sort of part I loved. Clean up around the house. Vacuum and mop. That can make you more fit and happier, too.
Yes. It was one of my favorite studies was one that found that people who vacuumed and had better moods. And it was not because their house was clean, although that may have been part of it. It was because that did contribute to the amount of physical activity they were doing. And there's a really clear correlation between physical activity of any kind, even if it's just standing up more often, and improved mood, improved thinking. improved memory, and less anxiety. So if you do nothing else for yourself, just stand up more often during the day, and you will probably feel better physically and emotionally.
You know, I was thinking about setting an alarm somewhere in my office that every 20 minutes it would go off. Because you say about every 20 minutes, stand mm-hmm. up, right?
Yes, I actually have a little – you can find apps now that will alert you every 20 minutes. You can set your phone. You can do all sorts of things. You can also do what I did, which is cobble together a very frankly, ugly, but very effective stand-up desk by piling up a bunch of dictionaries, putting your laptop on it. Stand up once in a while when you have something to write, when you're on the phone. Those are such easy ways to add some physical activity into your day, and it really will. It'll help you feel a lot better. It will help keep weight off, and it's just your body really wants that.
Yeah. Let's go back to high-intensity interval training, because you talk about how we can compress all of this exercise into a few minutes if you're willing to go through some of the intensity and some of the pain. There's a rat study that you write about conducted in Japan where you had these rats who the scientists had them swim for hours and hours, and then you had rats who swam for only minutes, like 4.5 minutes, and it looks like they had virtually the same aerobic benefits. To talk a little bit about that.
Yes, they had, in terms of the effects on the muscle cells, deep within the muscle cells, which are one of the key changes that occur when you train, they had the same changes as the mice that were doing very short, very intense swims had the same changes as those who were swimming for hours. They have found that in people, too. There was a study in which they compared people who were riding bikes at a, you know, brisk but not really hard pace for 90 minutes to 2 hours at a time. They compared them to those who rode a bicycle for 3 to 4 minutes at a really high, intense pace. They would actually go for 30 seconds as hard as they could, take a break for 10 seconds, go 30 seconds again. 3 to 4 minutes of those intervals produced the same changes in muscle cells as 90 minutes or more of bike riding. So you definitely can get physically fit in a really short period of time if you are willing to make yourself hurt. In practical terms, since most of us are not going to go all out, that's really hard, by the way. It's really to the point where you want to throw up. The same scientists did a practical study in which they found that get on a stationary bike, ride for 1 minute at about 90% of your maximum heart rate, which if you don't know your maximum heart rate, figure that's about a 9 on a scale of 1 to 10 yeah. in terms of unpleasantness. Do that for a minute. Go easy for a minute. Do the whole thing 10 times. You will almost certainly get the same fitness benefits as about an hour and a half or more of more normal endurance exercise. So that's doable.
Here's my favorite quote from your book, from Jack LaLanne. I'm going to clean it up a little bit. Warming up, he says, is the biggest bunch of horse crap I've ever heard in my life. So let's settle this, Gretchen Reynolds. Should we be stretching or not before a workout?
Generally, no. It appears to be the science is really clear. It's essentially counterproductive to do static stretching, which is where you sit on the ground, touch your toes, hold that pose for 30 seconds or more. The brain thinks you're about to overstretch that muscle and sends out signals that make it much harder for the muscle to contract or stretch. So you actually have made the muscle less ready for exercise than if you just warm up with a little bit of light movement. If you're going to run, just jog first. If you're going to play tennis, do some jumping jacks. What they call dynamic warm-ups seem to be the best way to prepare. And really, it's just another form of movement, getting yourself ready to move harder.
I didn't realize squats was such a good exercise. You really like squats.
Well, I like squats because the science shows they're really potent.
Yeah.
They work all the big muscles, most of the big muscles in the body, and certainly the big muscles that will help keep you independent all through your life. They're the muscles that will help you get up out of a chair and walk up and down stairs. They're also muscles that use a lot of blood sugar, which means calories.
Yeah.
Doing squats is a really good way to keep your knees healthy. It builds up the muscles around the knees. It appears to be pretty good at staving off back pain. So I never used to do squats until I looked at all of the science and talked to the scientists, and I do them now.
Mm.
You can do 20 of them, and that's a darn good little workout.
Yeah. Let me ask you this finally, about a minute left. You say in the book that most of us know that being sedentary isn't good for us, but we also think that being sedentary is something that happens to other people. We've become what some call active couch potatoes. Say something about that, if you would, finally.
I think that that's actually become the biggest shift in sort of lifestyle over the last generation, certainly, is that even those of us who would have said we're completely fit and healthy are actually sedentary and inactive for most of our lives. The human body is not meant to be quiet. It is meant to be moving at least a little bit all the time. Every system in your body works better if you move your body, even a little bit. So anything that you can do to not sit still all the time will make you healthier and happier. And it certainly changed my life. I move around a lot more now.
Gretchen Reynolds, she is writes, of course, the phys ed column for New York Times Well blog, the author of the book, The First 20 Minutes, Surprising Science Reveals How We Can Exercise Better, Train Smarter, and Live Longer. You should go get this book because there's lots of practical information in there. She joined us, by the way, from Santa Fe. Gretchen, thanks very much.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.